Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, the one and only Jim Sheridan talks about his fascinating new movie, Recreation, ahead of its showing at the Galway Film Fair, all about the imagined trial of Ian Bailey. We'll, of course, review the new Jurassic Park movie as well, and all the other week's new movies and TV reviews and news you'll need for the week ahead. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com, or the News Talk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all, and I hope you're doing well. I have a little summer cold. I mean, it's a cold. Sure, it's actually a summer one. It just happens to be in summer. So if there's any added nasalness, I do apologise. Not a huge amount I'm hearing in the headphones, but you'd be a better judge of that than I am, because I don't really know what my voice sounds like, you know. Anyway, I do hope you're well. And of course, I want to start the show mentioning the sad passing of the great Michael Madsen. People know him from a lot of Tarantino movies, from Reservoir Dogs to Kill Bill. He was in Donnie Brasco. Over 300 roles in TV and film. A real kind of brooding presence. He could be funny, but he could be very scary. And I suppose for many, his role that is most remembered is Mr. Blonde in Reservoir Dogs, playing, you know, a psycho, a slightly charming one at times, but a psycho, but a brilliant, I was going to say character actor, but you know, he was just a great actor. So RIP Michael Madsen. Now I want to start with a new movie that's not a new movie, but it's been restored and it is out in some select cinemas. Have a listen to this.
My film is not a movie. My film is not about Vietnam. It is Vietnam. It's what it was really like. It was crazy. And the way we made it was very much like the way the Americans were in Vietnam. We were in the jungle. There were too many of us. We had access to too much money, too much equipment, and little by little we went insane.
Francis Ford Coppola there, talking in Cannes ahead of the release or the showing of Apocalypse Now. Why am I playing that? Well, that is actually from a documentary called Hearts of Darkness, A Filmmaker's Apocalypse, which was a documentary that came out in 1991 all about Francis Ford Coppola making Apocalypse Now in the 1970s. Why am I talking about this? Because there is a new restored 4K version coming this Friday, the 4th of July, to the IFI and another few select cinemas. And this is maybe the greatest making of documentary you've ever seen. Now, people like me get very excited and spend lots of time talking about on-problem sets and when people were arguing on sets or things didn't arrive at the right time and there was chaos. I think the craziest on-set shenanigans were on making Apocalypse Now, and this is all captured in this brilliant documentary called Hearts of Darkness. So Francis Ford Coppola decamped to the Philippines in 1976 to make, you know, his masterpiece after The Godfather 1 and 2. And he was riding high on financial and critical success. And he filmed this movie, which is all about Vietnam. And as you probably know, Martin Sheen going to confront or find or possibly capture Colonel Kurtz, played by Marlon Brando. He filmed it in the Philippines, which had a civil war going on. He borrowed helicopters from the Philippines government, who they would sometimes call back if they needed to fight in the civil war. Harvey Keitel was cast, was fired after a week. Dennis Hopper was in a narcotic state of advancement, let's just say. Marlon Brando was getting paid $1 million a week. He showed up late. He hadn't read the script, it seems. He also was quite overweight at the time. Wasn't sure how engaged he was. That was Coppola's take on it. There was a typhoon while they were filming. Sets were destroyed. This was utter chaos. And here's the thing. It was all largely captured by Coppola's wife, Eleanor, who filmed it. And Coppola, really by his own admission, was kind of losing his mind in the jungle. This is a brilliant watch. If you have any interest in not just cinema, but how movies get made and how maybe they shouldn't be made and how it's a miracle any of them get made. So Hearts of Darkness, A Filmmaker's Apocalypse, it was out in 1991. It's now getting a limited cinema release again. I presume it will get a digital release as well. It is a terrific documentary. Talking of terrific documentaries, also out this week is a great new Irish one from our old friend, Ross Whittaker, who gave us great documentaries all about Katie Taylor and documentaries about surfing, phone boxes, all sorts of good stuff. Mark Pollock, Unbreakable, of course. He has been working on this a long time, because I know that because he spoke to me about it about 10 years ago, off air. Beat the Lotto. It is all about the famous syndicate that was launched. Younger listeners won't remember this. I vaguely remember it as a teenager when the Lotto, not long after it was up and running, they came up with a syndicate. A syndicate of people came together with this number cruncher who basically thought he could buy every possible ticket with every possible combination and attempted to beat the Lotto. You can Google it and find out if they did. But this story of what they came up with and how they attempted to beat the Lotto and how the Lotto fought back in the mid-90s is a brilliant watch. It's a heist movie about the Lotto. It's called Beat the Lotto. It's in cinemas from this Friday from Ross Whittaker. A great watch. Let me know what you might have been watching. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Last week we were raving about The Bear. I had watched 5 episodes. I had mentioned there's a wedding episode in 7, episode 7. I got to that this week. It's a brilliant episode. Again, it's one of those episodes that you could just sit down and watch and not really know the characters. And you see this family wedding with lots of complications unfold. So it's brilliant. So that's 2 weeks in a row I'm mentioning the 4th season of The Bear. But it is that good. Now, of course, the big new cinema release of the week is the 7th entry in the Jurassic Park / Jurassic World. That's another franchise on top of an already existing one called Jurassic World Rebirth. Scarlett Johansson is leading the troops this time, and there are lots of dinosaurs, I gather. Brian Lloyd, entertainment journalist and film critic, has seen it and joins me now. Brian, hello.
Hello, how are you?
It's complicated when you're introducing a movie with different franchises attached. Like, there was Jurassic Park, there's now Jurassic World, yet they're all part of the Jurassic Park franchise. It's complicated.
It is, but I mean, it's not really. I mean, it's dinosaurs. That's it. We live in this universe. There are dinosaurs are readily available. And there was the park, and then the park was shut down, and then the new theme park was built on top of it. That was Jurassic World. That failed, surprise, surprise. And then, you know, the two previous films, like Fallen Kingdom and then Dominion, were really, I mean, you know, like, and this is the kind of the problem that I had with Jurassic World Rebirth, was because say what you want about Fallen Kingdom, and I could say plenty about Dominion as well, at least they were trying to do something different. You know, like, you look at Fallen Kingdom, for example, and that was directed by Juan Antonio Bayona, who previously had done, like, you know, A Monster Calls and The Impossible, and he worked on the Lord of the Rings TV series as well. You know, it basically took dinosaurs, but then put it into a haunted house, literally a big, huge mansion, and had dinosaurs running around in it. Definitely different, definitely something we haven't seen before. And then in the case of Jurassic World Dominion, it was more about, you know, the kind of the oncoming ecological apocalypse, and how do dinosaurs play into that? And I mean, does humanity deserve to survive in a world that it has no respect for? And again, you know, definitely different. But in the case of, you know, Fallen Kingdom, it was good. It wasn't great. In the case of Dominion, I've never seen a dinosaur film so disinterested in dinosaurs to begin with.
Yeah.
So coming into this, you know, Rebirth, you know, there's a lot of clear tarmac, you know, that kind of way. They can build whatever they want on this. They can go anywhere with it.
So what's the story with this one?
So Scarlett Johansson is this former mercenary who's contacted by Rupert Friend, who works with this very big, very shadowy pharma company that wants to create a drug that can treat heart disease. And in order to do that, they're going to need to harvest blood samples from dinosaurs that have the biggest hearts. So that's a flying dinosaur, a land-based dinosaur, and a sea-based dinosaur.
Okay.
All of which is basically just the most, you know, paper thin excuse for how can we have a set piece set by this in the sea? How can we have a set piece involving an air based dinosaur? How can we have a set piece where it's a land based dinosaur and we can have the big kind of moments? Like, it's very much meat and potatoes plotting going on. But of course, along the way, what happens is that she has to hire in her friends. One of them is Mahershala Ali. The other is Ed Skrein. They sail a boat into dinosaur territory, which is, you know, obviously has been protected from the rest of the world because it's so inherently dangerous. But along the way, a family are sailing through, I think it's from San Francisco to Spain or something like mm-hmm. that. And they get into danger and Scarlett Johansson's boat has to go rescue them. All of which is just kind of, you know, rehashing Jurassic Park, which is basically putting kids in danger. But when they get to dinosaur territory, what you find is that really what Gareth Edwards does is, and it's quite incredible. I mean, I'm almost impressed by the level of blatantness. For 20 minutes when they're trying to capture this sea dinosaur, it's Jaws. And I mean, I'm not just talking about like a little cute little homage or a nifty little camera move that they do. They literally are just making Jaws the dinosaur in the sea. I mean, you literally have Scarlett Johansson running out to the top part of the boat, the edge, the plinth, the gangway or whatever, with a gun, and she's trying to fire it at the dinosaur sea creature like she's Quint or like she's Brody. And then, you know, of course, the big sea dinosaur starts attacking the boat. Again, completely like Jaws, the thing capsizes. They're all trying to scramble to survive. Again, exactly like Jaws. But then, of course, they make it to land. And then, you know, we're into 20 minutes of just Jurassic Park, like complete with the big sort of Brontosaurus and the beautiful music from John Williams, now composed by Alexandre Desplat. And all while this is happening, then the young family then have gone a separate way. They've been separated from them and they're doing the sort of Sam Neill storyline in Jurassic Park, where it's a young family basically just trying to survive. Mm-hmm. And then it cuts into Raiders of the Lost Ark, where they go into this sort of Aztec temple. And we see Jonathan Bailey, who's this paleontologist that's tagging along for the ride, finds an egg and picks it up. And I mean, again, blatantly, just incredibly blatant, picks it up like it's the little statue from Raiders of the Lost Ark, complete with the light shining down and the sort of temple motif. And then the final 20 minutes of that, and I swear this is all kind of, again, I'm really not joking, like the final 20 minutes of it is like Aliens, where they're trying to get out of a power generator station and they're going underneath these power ducts, like water ducts underneath mm-hmm. the whole station, and they're being chased by dinosaurs through these ducts like the aliens in Aliens. So, you know, and again, the thing of it is, like, Gareth Edwards, like, he's very competently directing this film, you know, that kind of way. Like, when it's a Jaws film, it looks exactly like a Jaws film. I mean, and then when it goes into Raiders of the Lost Ark, it's quite tense and, you know, there's greenery and there's the light and, you know, Jonathan Bailey, if you almost squint, kind of looks like Harrison Ford. And then finally, when it goes into the third act, and it goes into Aliens, you have the big percussive score, you have the kind of retro futuristic cassette futurism kind of vibe to it. Mm. So really what this is like, it's just, what if we put Jaws, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and Aliens into a dinosaur film? What if we put that into ChatGPT or Midjourney, one of these AIs? And what would it crap out the other side? Basically, Rebirth.
Well, look, Steven Spielberg is an executive producer. Two of those movies you mentioned, he was the director on. So this is not just kind of pastiche in places. It almost feels like not a ripoff, but far too close to the wind.
Oh, no. Yeah. I mean, no, I mean, it's not even a ripoff. It's outright theft. Do you know what I mean? That's what I mean. Like, it's I can appreciate an homage. I can appreciate, you know, we're going for the same vibe as any of those films that I mentioned, but this is just blatant. And again, I mean, I'm not mad. In a way, I'm not mad because, like, Gareth Edwards does it very, very well. Like, it really does look like a Jaws movie. It really does look like Raiders of the Lost Ark. And this is not, this is something that he's done before. Like, I mean, you go back and watch Rogue One as an example, you know, it has the look, the feel, the texture of, you know, Star Wars from the 70s, you know, that kind of way. And the famous story on Rogue One was that he basically talked, when he was talking to all the British actors and stuff, he told them, look, I want you to grow out your sideburns. I want you to grow out your mustaches. Cut your hair. We'll have your hair cut to make it look like you guys were actors in the 70s. Because he wanted that kind of, he wanted that sort of texture to it, you know? And even how he shot it as well. Like,
You know, for Jurassic Park lovers and Jurassic World lovers, it's all about the dinosaurs. Are the dinosaurs impressive in this?
They are, but I mean, so what? Jurassic Park was one of the very first films I ever saw in a cinema.
Yeah.
And you look at it now, I mean, what kind of jumps out at you, I think, is the ability to use practical effects as much as possible and use CGI as sparingly as possible. Like, take for example, like the raptor scene in the kitchen, right? It was, all it needed was just like a couple of strings to push, you know, cardboard boxes out of the way, and you could see just like the talon of the raptor peeking out. And you know, when you see that that great shot of the raptor sticking its sticking half its face in the round mirror and then blowing its smoke its nostrils out, it's all practical effects. You look at that and you know it looks real. Whereas in Jurassic World Rebirth and all the previous Jurassic World films, it's CGI. It's you, and I don't care what people say. I don't care how good CGI gets. You can tell. You can always tell when it's CGI and when it's practical effects.
Yeah.
And this, I mean, again, you know, the dinosaurs look great and everything, but I know it's not real. Like, they don't have, it doesn't have the same level of texture. It doesn't have the same kind of tactile quality that the original had. And I mean, they've had 7 attempts at it now. They're never going to recreate that.
Absolutely. And listeners heard me saying this last week, but I interviewed Don Lessam in the zoo last week, the dinosaur advisor on the very first one.
Yeah.
And it's not just because he wasn't involved in the other 6, but he just said, in terms of dinosaurs, they just got stupider and stupider. And in that audience in the zoo last week, there was people there with Jurassic Park t-shirts, adults getting him to sign it. People love that first movie and adore it from its head to its toes. So it's a shame they've done this, you know?
It is, but I mean, Jurassic Park is our generation's Jaws. I mean, you had Jaws, you had Jaws of Revenge, you had Jaws 3D.
Yeah.
And, you know, none of them were as good as the original.
No,
none,
I know.
None of them come even close to it. They never have. They've never been able to do it. But, you know, Universal just seemed to just crank them out because, I don't know, like, I mean, maybe there's an element of like, okay, we can make this cheaply and, you know, one of these things has got to hit eventually, you know? I mean, and it's the same with like the Fast and the Furious movies. I mean, but I mean, you know, you can roll your eyes at them, but I mean, look at what, like, you know, Fast and the Furious, the very, very first one, and then look at like Fast 5, for example. They recognized, okay, we can make a gear shift here, no pun intended, and go in a different direction, again, no pun intended, and it'll work. And I mean, really with Jurassic Park is, it's, oh my God, dinosaurs are still around.
Yeah.
And you got that with the first movie. And then everything after that then has just been diminishing returns. Like, no one is interested in it. And again, I will give credit to Jurassic World and Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom and even Jurassic World Dominion. It acknowledges the fact that, you know, audiences are sort of blasé about the thrill and spectacle of dinosaurs. So, you know, the theme park has to keep coming up with even bigger dinosaurs, even scarier dinosaurs. And the filmmakers themselves have to concoct more and more reasons for people to go into harm's way with dinosaurs. And in Jurassic World Rebirth, it's like, okay, we're going in purely for the money. We're going in purely to harvest these dinosaurs for pharmaceutical research. And again, yeah, fine. But, you know, the way to go about it is just so lacking in creativity. It's so lacking in originality that it's fine. I mean, it's all very competent. It's all very well done. But so what?
What's the point? Yeah,
what's the point?
I mean, Here's the crazy idea. Maybe just stop making Jurassic Park movies and find some new monsters to write about or something like that. But anyway, what are you going to say stars-wise for Jurassic World Rebirth?
I mean, two out of five. I mean,
it's okay. I think you're being generous.
I probably am. But I mean, God, I mean, like, you know, Peter Bradshaw in The Guardian gave this 4 stars. And I mean, my God, I mean, talk about generous, like, you know?
Yeah, that sounds very generous. Now, I haven't seen it. And I'm not sure I'm going to, by the sounds of things. Jurassic World Rebirth is in cinemas as we speak. I think it was released on Wednesday or Thursday of this week to get that early school holiday audience. But Brian Lloyd is giving it a paltry enough to. Brian, thanks a million.
Thanks, Melon.
Look, this island was a laboratory of sorts. They conducted experimental work here.
What kind of experiments?
Crossbreeding of species, engineered entertainments, they call them.
Genetically altered freaks?
Any that were malformed or just too damn hard for anybody to look at. They left them here.
Well, that's inhuman. Why not just euthanize them?
The average cost of a created species is $72 million. What would you do? Kill it and have to tell your bank or just carry it forward under R&D?
What would I do with mutant dinosaurs from an accounting perspective? Is that really the question?
A clip there from Jurassic World Rebirth, the 7th installment in Jurassic World. It may be time to stop, people. That's what Brian Lloyd is saying. Up next, the great Jim Sheridan joins me in studio to talk about his new film, Recreation. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. I'm delighted to say that I'm joined in corporeal form in studio by the one and only Jim Sheridan. He's here to talk about a few things, but most notably, his new movie, Recreation, which, as the name implies, recreates or creates the trial that Ian Bailey never got for the murder of Sophie Toscan de Plantier. Jim previously gave us a documentary series all about it 2 years ago, Murder at the Cottage. Jim, of course, has given us movies like In the Name of the Father, In America, and of course, My Left Foot. I've never met him in person, so it's a delight to have him here. He does actually exist. Jim, hello.
How are you? Good to be here.
I'm going to ask you a few obvious questions because I have to. So I was telling my wife about this and she said, but why is he doing that? Like, he just made Murder at the Cottage 2 or 3 years ago. So I know it's a very obvious question, but did you not have your say?
Not really. You know, like when you're doing something like, say, Murder at the Cottage, you're limited by the remit of Sky and people who are looking for over their shoulder to see where the insurance is.
Okay.
You know, what you're going to say and, you know, and it's okay if you're saying the guy killed her because he's been convicted in France and you can get away with anything. There's no chance you could be sued for defamation.
Yeah.
And when he did take a defamation case against the press, they kind of basically made it, they struck out 5 or 6 of the charges or more and made it, do you believe Marie Farrell or do you believe the police? And everybody asked Marie, who is the man in the car with you? And I said to her, I don't care who the man in the car with you was with you. You know, I just want to know who is the man outside the car? And nobody's asked you that for 20 years. And it seems a simple question to me. If she comes along and says, I was lying, it wasn't Ian Bailey, then the question is, who was it?
Mm.
Not the important question is she lying or not? Like, nobody would go along and voluntarily say, I'm a liar and I perjured myself and I'm going to get myself in deep shit if they didn't feel guilt and they want to put the record straight. That's what I thought. And I went along to her and said, well, you know, who was it? And she said she didn't know. But then eventually she came back with a name and I think she gave an affidavit and I think the police took it and still nobody, seems to me, has talked to that person.
It seems to me from both Murder and Cottage and particularly Recreation, you think there's reasonable doubt that he didn't do it, right? So why has the narrative been that he did? Like, who do you see has gained from that?
The person who killed her has gained.
Okay.
5'10", sallow complexion, beret, long black coat. Mm-hmm. 5'10", yeah. Beret, sallow complexion, long black coat. Dan Griffin saw him. Marie Farrell saw him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if some
and those proportions don't match the now deceased Ian Bailey.
No, and the beret definitely doesn't. And the sallow complexion doesn't. And the fact that somebody's waiting outside the shop. Now, you don't notice somebody following somebody.
Mm.
Like, we're in the studio here to describe it for the people listening. And there's a window. And if somebody's on the other side of that window, it's unlikely that you're going to observe them.
Mm.
So if somebody was watching Sophie surreptitiously across the road, he'd be in the butcher shop he's standing outside of, not standing outside the butcher's.
Mm.
So it seemed to me, the minute I read the statements, that no, he's with Sophie and she's with him, except she doesn't want to be seen with him. Now, I don't know if that's true, but it's much more likely scenario. If you're directing an actor, like what the actor standing outside the shop, you say, what are you doing? Well, I'm following her. No, mm. Like, you're following her. Like, you're not following her. You're inside the... Get inside the shop and be real. And so the shop would be Sophie comes out. Wait, 1, 2, 3, 4. He comes out of the other shop. Not, he's standing outside the other shop. And the minute she comes out, he follows her. So it seemed to me that there was a chance that that person might... She may... Well, so now an old man of 90 notices and a young, attractive, beautiful... spiritual woman of 39 doesn't notice. Like, it doesn't make sense.
Mm. Why was he found guilty in the French court, do you think?
Because they let's say OJ got off because his hand wouldn't fit in the glove.
Yeah.
Bailey got convicted in the public opinion because Marie Farrell said he was following Sophie. The minute you take her evidence out, there's no evidence. And even if there was evidence, it would fail on the fact that she reversed her stay. You couldn't go to court in Ireland with Marie Farrell or without her. But they went to France and they didn't bring her. Because in their minds, in their minds, it's not a real trial. In their minds, it's, oh, we're only finding him guilty so he can come to France and have a real trial.
And I know you've answered this before, but just as we're discussing it, her family... are upset that this is re-emerging. Like, what do you do with that? Or do you have to do anything with it?
Well, I was down with Ian Bailey and his sister throwing his ashes into the sea in West Cork, and they're upset.
Mm. Because no one was at his funeral?
No, because, like, he lived a horrible life and he was blamed for something he didn't do. You know, there's two things. If you're dealing with trauma and grief, really you have to be dealing with the living and the dead. Like, I walked into Jim Swire, who was the father of the girl who died in Lockerbie, you know?
Okay.
And his wife and her, Jim, are the most beautiful people. And he brought me up to his bedroom, and in front of his bed was a 10-foot picture drawing, painting by a rabbi in New York of his daughter because she was dating a Jewish boy. And he showed it to me, and I said, oh, what's that?
A picture
the size of this small iPhone.
Yeah.
And he just leaned in and he said, oh, that's Kathy, my other daughter. And I said, what age is she? And he looked at his wife and he said, is she 40? And I said, no, she's 46. I was trying to say the living are more important than the dead.
Mm.
Now, I know this from my own family, where my brother Peter, who's a total sweetheart, you know,
yes,
he one day said something about my brother Frankie, who died, to my parents. Do you remember? You know, this is his anniversary, something like that. And they got really irate because parents can't deal with children yeah. dying. And I don't know if you know the Van Gogh story. Van Gogh was born the day... on the exact same day as his brother who died, whose name was Vincent.
Mm-hmm.
So every day he went out and saw Vincent on a tombstone.
Yeah.
And that made him have two things. One, suicidal.
Mm.
The only way I can make my mother happy is to be suicidal. When I'm dead, she loved me as much as the other guy.
Yeah.
And I think in terms of the Lockerbie story, like when they put it out, Kathy came out against it. Now, I'm saying you have to be really careful when you're using an emotion as volatile and destabilizing and unemotional as grief. You can't then take that emotion and turn her into a
logic,
legal decision.
We're going to get to the actual movie because this is a film show, but I thought in the past you were saying there's reasonable doubt here, but you did say a couple of minutes ago for something he didn't do. Are you at that kind of unequivocal point now where you think he didn't do it?
Well, I just want to put two pictures in your head. Ian Bailey, black, long black coat, funny trilby hat, 6'4", pale, 5'10", sallow complexion, beret. Now, so long as you have the first one in your head, you're not going to think of the second. So it's almost like when you, if you say this guy is a murderer, it's not quite the same as saying somebody's a paedophile. But if you say somebody's a paedophile, they'll never recover.
Yeah. Tell me this. I was really surprised. You're in it. Mm-hmm. You're the, I was going to say the Henry Fonda character, but you're not.
No.
But why did you put yourself in it?
It was just a practical decision that.
You're not going to tell me you were the cheapest actor you could find or something like that.
Yeah, like I'm the foreman in the original.
Yeah.
He's kind of a boring character, you know, but.
Yeah.
I thought, like, I can't be running in and out telling people what to say.
Yeah.
So if I'm in on the floor, I can direct it, you know, like I had Dave Merriman watching the screen. Dave was the other director. And, you know, we split what we did. And so I was free for the first time to kind of do a performance or not worry about performing. And I wasn't, initially I wasn't thinking I was going to have a big part at all. But as it went on,
you grew into it.
Well, I knew so much information.
I know, that it made the most sense. And tell me this, why the aping 12 Angry Men? Is that just a film that's always been with you? Or you thought this is a perfect analysis of what needs to be done and if there were a trial for Ian Bailey?
Yeah, there were two reasons. We were creating this kind of art house, Vicky Cripes and me discussing the murder in various locations and sets. And the producers in Luxembourg were building sets and rang up and told Dave Merriman that we were $300,000 over budget. And I was very shocked. And I pulled pages and sent back 20 instead of 30 or 5 or something. And they come back with, we're $500,000 over. And I'm like, okay. So I just flew over and said, one set, a room, and I'll do 12 Angry Men homage. I love 12 Angry Men, love Sidney Lumet. It's a brilliant movie with very sophisticated camera moves that I didn't have a chance to make. The only advantage I had was that I didn't have to describe the suspect.
Mm.
The audience knew who the suspect was. In 12 Angry Men, I don't think they have one shot of a kid.
Yeah.
And he doesn't look like the guy who killed.
Yeah.
And they probably put that in after they shot the movie.
Mm.
So the IP of our one is it's a jury about a person you know, about a trial you know. Mm. And I'm very interested in this. I'm going to do something in relation to releasing the movie. What I'm going to do is I think I'm going to find a situation where I put all the statements through artificial intelligence and see what they tell me.
Okay. Are you going to film that process?
Yeah, I'm going to film it, yeah.
Okay.
And just, I'm very engaged now with the idea of truth and reality because the movies have shifted so far away from it. Like, again, that window that you have in here, which most people would know, it looks like a police interrogation room, but in a police station, you don't see the people on the other side. But that's a frame, yeah?
Yeah.
When film was film, it was 48 frames. So what percentage of the movie was the frame? Well, it has to be 5-10%.
Yeah.
So for 10% of the movie, you were in flickering dark.
Yeah.
And it was hypnotic. But what it created was a sense from a projector with smoke in it, that it was an artificial experience.
Yeah.
So when you take out the projector, which you don't really need with pixels, but the audience now know that what they're watching maybe didn't happen. In the old film world, you always thought it happened.
Yeah.
But now you think, oh, they can change the surface. Once you can change the surface, you're not in film anymore. You're not in Texas anymore. You're just in Yellow Brick Road.
Yeah.
Everything's Yellow Brick Road
yeah.
now. Nothing's truth. The surface can be manipulated and nobody believes what they're watching. It used to be you believe what you're watching, you found it difficult to believe what you heard.
Yeah.
But now it's
the opposite.
It's not the opposite, but it creates a spiritual difference between the experience of film and digital. So having that, I want to just ground what I'm doing really deep in reality,
yeah.
in what you're watching is real.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay. So that is Recreation we are talking about. It's going to be shown at the Film Fla, the Galway Film Fla, on the 8th of July. That's next Tuesday at 7 p.m. in the Town Hall. For information about it and indeed all of the events at the Film Fla, go to galwayfilmfla.com. Jim's Movie Recreation is also going to be in Omniplex cinemas across Ireland, exclusively in Omniplex cinemas from October the 3rd. Loads more to talk to Jim about after the break. Stay tuned. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time. I'm in studio here with Jim Sheridan, or Jim Sheridan's in studio with me. Who knows? And we were talking before the break about his new movie, Recreation, that is on at the Galway Film Flat next week, the 8th of July. A lot more to talk about. Jim, you were talking earlier about raising money, and I'm wondering, is it getting harder or easier? Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the state and future of cinema?
I am beyond pessimistic about the state of cinema. I think we're in a kind of really crisis area where we're the equivalent of bookshops and Amazon.
Mm.
So you see these big trucks of Amazon driving down the road. They stop. People can't go by. Takes time to get round them. Takes time to unload them. They're delivering stuff and all the shops are closing. But who built the roads that Amazon are driving the trucks on?
Yeah, mm.
We did. So who created the infrastructure around the world for TV and everything? Well, the BBC in Ireland and da-da-da. But they're using the internet now, which is the equivalent of what Daniel did in, you know, There Will Be Blood, of the yeah. straw going under.
Yeah.
So now the straw has gone under. RT has been eliminated. BBC has been eliminated. Channel Arte has been eliminated. So all the people that used to buy cinemas are being eliminated.
Mm.
And now when you make a film, it's in their interest not to buy it. Because if they can eliminate the producers of cinema, they can close the cinemas. And if they can close the cinemas, everybody's on the couch.
So what are you going to do?
Well, I'm going to do radical things about returning cinema to its community aspect.
Right.
You know, like
event cinema?
Maybe,
almost?
Yeah, event yeah. cinema. But it might be strange events.
Okay.
You mightn't have seen the like.
So, okay.
You know, it might be all night events.
Yeah. And then just going back to that. So did you have any moral quandaries about making a TV series for Sky then, if they're part of the problem? I'm not saying you yeah. should have had, but
No. I was just dying to get somebody to make it. Like, I had approached Storyville BBC. The person who was running Storyville went to Netflix, didn't tell me, took the idea, even though Storyville wanted to commission me to make it. And now they were doing it for Netflix.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you can't do that. And they're like, we've got a lot of money. And so, I was trying to find who I could sell out to.
Okay.
Do you understand?
And you chose Rupert Murdoch. So yeah. Let me ask you about one or two other movie things and then I'll let you go. The 50 Cent movie, I haven't yeah. seen in a long time. Yeah. But you, by the time you made that, you'd been around and you'd been to America and all. But, you know, you used the phrase, we're not in Texas anymore.
Yeah.
Was that a weird trip making that one? Because I'm sure it wasn't like anything else you'd
done.
Yeah,
it was weird. It was kind of like, you know, in another way, Daniel Day talks about that he has to have some inner resource to be able to find something new in acting or what Parity's doing. It's a bit like that. I'd done five movies, I think, set in Ireland, and I was looking to do a movie in America, and it felt like something, 50 felt like somebody I knew from Sheriff Street, you know?
Okay.
And just the fact that he's black makes it so radically different. But it was a very strange movie because let's say that you're watching John Wayne and basically you're thinking, oh, yeah, John Wayne, there he is, yeah. Oh, yeah, I know what he's thinking. That's the audience.
Yeah.
With 50 Cent, it's, oh, what's he thinking? And so you've broken a chain and it's just a different experience and you have to be careful how you walk and tread it. And so that was unusual for me. You know, I remember it was previewed on the Paramount lot and every day I'd drive into Paramount, meet all the execs, how are you, coffee, yeah. And then one day I was like, why is everybody black today? And I was like, why is it? And then I went into the cinema and everybody was black.
Okay.
And I said to them, what's going on? And they said, it's an urban movie, Jim.
Did you make a lot of money out of that one?
Yeah, no, I made a good, like, you know, fee.
Yeah, okay.
But I got paid more for doing The Boxer than I got paid for Get Rich.
Okay, that's interesting.
And, you know, I wrote the stupidest little stupid rap for, it was meant to be foolish, you know, on the floor.
Right.
And I got paid more for that in residuals than any other movie I made. Just for that, 30 seconds.
Can you remember the rap?
No, I can't. I can't remember what it was, but yeah, no.
No, I did, okay. We can watch the movie back.
Boy, but, you know.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, but I can't remember what it was. But I love rap, you know. I love Notorious. I loved Tupac, you know, all those early guys. I love them.
Okay.
And 50's quite good. He's very good. He's great.
Have you listened to any Kneecap?
Kneecap are the best.
Okay.
Cart galore, they are, yeah. They're great. I mean, you know, Kneecap are, they have the beauty of attack, purity, careless, youth. Like, I turned up in the court for them in, not for them, just to support free speech in...
In London?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I met Gareth Pearce again. And
yeah.
We had a talk and... unfortunately, I didn't get to meet the man from Phoenix Law. I wanted to meet
him. Okay.
You know, I'm interested in kind of the way the legal...
Yeah, of course.
The legals in the north are different from the legals in the south.
Yeah, or anywhere else maybe.
Yeah, anywhere else. Because they've been through a lot, you know, they get shot.
Yeah. It's funny. My favourite film of yours is In the Name of the Father, if I had to pick one.
Yeah.
And the thing that's amazing about that, I think, is Daniel's performance. Everyone heralds him for all sorts. There Will Be Blood and My Left Foot. But In the Name of the Father, I met Jerry Conlon once in school.
Yeah, yeah.
He was so not Daniel Day-Lewis in that. Yeah. I'm wondering, were you surprised by how good he was? Was there a moment where you thought, geez, he's got it, or he's got it and then some? Don't want to put words in your mouth.
No, no. Like, with Daniel, I had that experience on...
Everything.
Yeah, well, on My Left Foot, definitely, you know.
Mm.
And I don't, these things happen, you know. Like, I would say, I don't know if I bring anything to Daniel, you know. I mean, he's proved without me that he can be the best actor in the world. So I'm just happy to be there in his presence, directing him. I love him as a person, you know, and as an actor. And he's just special. He has, it's almost in, like integrity's born into his soul, you know.
That's a lovely way of putting it, yeah.
And he was great as Jerry.
He sure was.
Yeah.
Would you be able to get him out of retirement, do you think?
Yeah, he's out of retirement. He's back working.
Okay.
Well, at least he did his son Ronan's movie. And I think, you know, probably, you know, he just needs to be away from, oh, there's Daniel Day-Lewis, and, you know, and he'll probably come back and do stuff, you know. If I found a role for him, yeah, definitely, I'd love him to do it. It's kind of hard because, you know, you don't, if you write for an actor, you're limiting what you can do.
Yeah.
Whereas if you just write and the actor does it, like I'd write that, like to write a role Daniel can't do, because I think he could do it, if you know, that kind of perverse. So, you know, it's like, I remember going to a lecture by this guy who's supposed to be the, he was the guy who was the biggest lecturer in cinema. And he had the, he was fabulous talking about the Casablanca movie. And then he said, you know, you're right for an actor. Think of Tom Cruise or, you know, don't be, once you think of that, he says, you know, you're on the right road. I said to him, do you never think of yourself? And he's like, no. And I was like, wow. I said, if there's a dog barking in a film that has my face, like, you know, I only imagine myself doing every part.
Yeah.
And I think the problem with writing for stars is that it becomes pastiche.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
I can imagine.
But, you know, I think there will be a turnaround, I hope, in cinema some way. I think digital broke the structure of people going to see dramas.
Yeah.
Because they're like, but the person can fly, Jim, and why are you having them walking? Like, they can be Superman, and they can do weird things, and you can do great things with film. So, with digital. So, it just broke the connection between truth and the viewer. And before anything is a narrative, before anything is a myth, before anything is any structural, semiotic, whatever you want to call it, philosophical approach, there's belief.
Mm.
And belief is fundamental.
Yeah.
And if you don't believe it, you check out.
And just, you've spent far too long here, so I'm going to let you go. But tell me this, do you ever watch TV?
I watch a little bit of TV, but I usually get bored.
Okay. And,
you know, when I have the power of the remote,
I
feel like a big fella. You know, I just can fast forward or stop it or go to the loo or have a drink. And I always have a drink or go to the loo.
Okay.
And I don't go back.
And so when someone goes to see one of your movies in a cinema, they can't pause it. So, I mean, that's important.
Well, it's the difference between, like, it's kind of like, okay, there's a match on today and I can't quite get to see it.
Yeah.
And I'll record it and I won't watch the result. And I'll go home and I'll fast forward to
it. I know,
Because it's not the same experience.
Absolutely not, no.
And so the liveness went out of cinema.
And you want to bring it back if you can, in some fashion.
Yeah, I think it needs a new approach, you know. It needs an approach of, I don't want to say this, but I'm so sick of entertainment.
Okay.
I hate it. If somebody tries to entertain me, I'm going to hit them. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, give me enough. I've enough entertainment. I get up in the morning and I'm being entertained. And all day I'm being entertained. So I wanted to stop at a certain point.
Mm.
And I want somebody to get real. I want somebody to have a bit of soul and not be fucking selling me a bag of goods.
Well, Recreation, which is going to be in the Galway Film Flan. I didn't say to you on air, but it's a beguiling watch.
Good.
And my wife saw it with me and Well and thought exactly the same. And she's the woman who started by saying, why is he doing this?
Mm.
And then at the end of it was like, wow, that was amazing. So
good.
Thank you very much and continued success. Jim Sheridan there talking to me about all sorts of things. His views on the state of cinema, some of the people he's worked with, and of course earlier, Recreation, his new movie, which I want to tell you again, is going to be at the Galway Film Fla in the on the 8th of July. If you want to find out more about the Galway Film Fla, galwayfilmfla.com. It's going to be in the Town Hall next Tuesday, the 8th of July. Recreation is going to get a nationwide cinema release in Omniplex cinemas exclusively from October the 3rd. And my thanks to Jim for all of that. That is it for this week. Thank you for listening. Get in touch with me at any stage. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, although I don't really use Twitter much anymore, to tell you the truth. So why not email me, screentime@newstalk.com. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend. Have a safe week ahead, and I will talk to you all next week.